Good morning, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano. I want to welcome you to Political Perspectives here on KBOO 90.7 FM, your own community radio station, and we are so lucky to have KBOO. My guest today is Daniel Lurch, who is the editor, and along with Richard Heinberg, of the Post-Carbon Reader, Managing the 21st Century Sustainability Crisis. It is a big, fat book, full of all kinds of really great information and discussions. And so it's also very connected to the transition movement, which works on the ground with leaders and thinking and action and grassroots organizing. And it's challenging, hopeful, and exciting, this book is. Daniel Lurch is program director of the Post-Carbon Institute, and the author of also Post-Carbon Cities, Planning the Energy Climate Uncertainty, the first major guidebook for local governments in peak oil and global warming. He's delivered many lectures and is organizing in Portland and other places. So certainly with this book, must be widespread. I've been doing interviews about peak oil since, for about 8 years or something, when it was a brand new subject. And now people, I think, are starting to wake up to it as a lot of things are changing in our country and in the world. So it's a very important subject. And again, the book is called The Post-Carbon Reader, Managing the 21st Century's Sustainability Crisis. So welcome to you, Daniel Lurch.
Thank you, Sue. Good to be back here with you.
And then, so it must have been quite something to bring all this book together. It's got a lot of pages.
It was a project, 544 pages. It's taken us about a year and a half to put this book together. We started assembling it back in 2008, I'd say a few months after the oil price spike in July of 2008, when oil went to about $147 a barrel, and at Post-Carbon Institute, we started to realize that the game had essentially changed. Up until that point, we'd spent a lot of time talking about peak oil and relocalization, and then after that point with the price spike, and then, of course, in September 2008, we saw Lehman Brothers collapse. We saw major problems on Wall Street. We decided at Post-Carbon Institute that the time, it was a moment for us to move beyond the peak oil conversation and start talking about some of the deeper problems that we face in the world. And this book is a result of that. We shifted our mission at Post-Carbon. We went out and recruited about 29 different fellows. Shifting microphones.
We got to have a different little mic shift here.
Is that better?
We recruited 29 different. That's much better. We recruited 29 different fellows, including some people that folks may recognize, like Bill McKibben, David Orr, Wes Jackson, the father of sustainable agriculture, and some folks that people might not recognize. Sandra Pestel, who's now the first freshwater fellow of National Geographic, David Fridley, a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. We brought these people together because we saw that if we were going to talk about the deeper issues, go beyond peak oil, we really needed to bring in some expertise on some very specific matters. In the case of David Fridley, for example, he's an expert on renewable energies. What does it actually take to bring something like a solar energy at community, at statewide, at large scale? What does it take to bring that online? What are you talking about in terms of the materials needed to build that capacity? Even rare earth minerals and the really scarce materials like that. Thinking about the energy returned on energy invested of some of these materials and some of these technologies. These are the sorts of things that really are kind of missing in the mainstream sustainability discussion. And we found that, now that people kind of got peak oil after 2008, if they're starting to look for solutions, we wanted to be influencing that discussion so that they will be finding the right solutions and not just, for example, transitioning to natural gas or some of the other quick fixes that we often hear about.
That, of course, this natural gas issue is a very big one in Oregon now, as they want to bring natural gas through here and really trash Oregon, basically.
Yeah, whether it's building a new pipeline for this increased capacity, or it's the, of course, all the problems that we've all heard about with the fracking process, hydraulic fracturing, underground with unconventional natural gas in Pennsylvania, New York, and elsewhere, and what that means for communities and their groundwater supplies. And this is, and I think that's maybe a good encapsulation of what this book, The Post-Carbon Reader, is about. I gave a reading of the reader at Powell's on Hawthorne last week, and one of the things I tried to demonstrate from the beginning was that each one of these issues that we discuss, whether it's water or energy or food, social equity, or peak oil, has many, many other issues connected with it. All these issues are connected. You start talking about even renewable energy, you have to be talking about population. You have to be talking about consumption. You have to be talking about toxins and all these other things. Natural gas. Here in Oregon, it's the government and then these big companies trying to buy up a big chunk of land and ram this giant pipeline through national forests and private land in other areas. But there are these deeper issues and these other issues like the toxins in the communities, like public, like private rights, like social equity again. And there's really, in the mainstream conversation, we just don't hear about these issues being talked about with that kind of complexity in mind. The mainstream news likes to make things simple in terms of sound bites, which is understandable. As you know, you've got 30 seconds to describe something on the news. You need to make it simple. So we're trying to educate people for that next step to show them, no, this is all very, very complex, but it's also understandable. If we have the right tools and the right frameworks, we can start to make sense of it. And for that, our framework is resilience, the idea that we need to be – the way to address these things is not piecemeal, but overall thinking about how can we build the resilience of our communities, of our society, and make our decisions from that standpoint rather than looking at quick-fix solutions.
Right, and a lot of these quick-fix solutions use a lot of oil. People never – I mean, we're so – our society, country, culture is so based on oil that people – I mean, when you start thinking about, oh, we could make this, oh, we could do that, oh, but that, you know, takes more oil.
Exactly.
So resilience sounds like a good one. And that means back to us, our own selves and our own individual lives, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. And you mentioned before in your introduction the transition movement. That's another thing that changed in 2008. We saw, at that point, Post-Carbon Institute was running this thing called the Relocalization Network, which some of your readers may be familiar with. The Relocalization Network was an international network of grassroots organizations, all working for, obviously, relocalization, which means that they were trying to – they weren't doing direct advocacy necessarily. They weren't doing activism in the way that people normally think about it. They were trying to find projects and events that they could do at the local level to build local resilience. That's what it kind of came down to. 2007, 2008, we saw the rise of the transition towns movement. It started in the UK, then it started spreading here, and we decided at Post-Carbon Institute that that was a model that worked very, very well in many situations, not all situations, but many situations. And rather than trying to duplicate efforts, we should join efforts. So we provided them with some seed funding. We got very involved with helping them get established over here. And now that's we consider that one of the very important things that we do, trying to help grow this grassroots movement for building local resilience, because you know we can try to influence policy at the national level or at state level. We can try to influence businesses through frameworks like the Natural Step, which is based here in Oregon. There's all these different things you can do at these higher levels, but if you're not, and people and the cable listeners especially, and we here in Portland know this, if you're not making those changes at the local communities, particularly within the local culture, they're not only are they not going to stick, you're probably, in some cases, you're not even going to get the right kind of responses, because it's the local people who understand the kinds of challenges they're facing, and it's the local people who understand what kind of solutions are available and what they can pursue.
Do you think that most people nowadays understand the issue of oil running out? And then do some people, like myself, at least in theory, would say. Although it's hard. It's really, really hard to wean yourself from oil. But do you think that most people understand that it's an issue even?
I think there are gradations of understanding. My sense, I mean, and I was very fortunate that my first book, Post Carbon Cities, came out in late 2007. So I went on the road for a couple of months doing presentations and tours. So I got to see firsthand how my audiences, many of which were local government agencies and planners and architects, I got to see firsthand month by month how their awareness about peak oil and peak fossil fuel issues would change. Because it was very, I mean, when my book came out, oil was probably around $60 a barrel. It came out in October. By January 2008, it was just touching 100. And then by July, of course, it was up at 147. So, there was always debate. There are always people who have very strong feelings one way or another. The one side, the cornucopians, who feel that, well, the market will take care of everything. We don't need to worry. And the other side, the doomers, the serious doomers who feel that are worried about imminent societal collapse because of peak oil. The truth, of course, is somewhere in the middle. And the folks in the middle just will kind of sit back and watch and wonder what was happening and just watch the mainstream news. But when oil prices are rising or are climbing at the rate that they were in that time period, it becomes very, very obvious. So I would say by early 2008, most professional audiences, most government audiences understood that there was a serious problem. They might not have understood the reasons behind the problem. I think the way that they understand the problem is going to be very different from the way that your usual peak oiler will. Most of these people, they don't know and they don't care about, say, M. King Hubbert and depletion curves and all these things. What they understand is kind of the intuitive concept that oil is a finite resource. We produce it in kind of this bell curve, and therefore it kind of makes a lot of sense once you get those two things that we can't keep increasing demand for oil and also increasing the supply of oil indefinitely. There comes a point where the supply has to start going down, and it makes sense at that point might be now. So I think most, I'd say probably 75% of people, if not more in this country, get that part. Uh-huh. Where the divergence comes is you have some people, and unfortunately I think it's increasingly more, who feel that we will deal with that problem simply by transitioning to other fossil fuels and like natural gas, like coal, and eventually to different technologies like renewables. And then you have, I don't want to do opposites here, but people on the other side, and I would put post-carbon in this camp, who feel that if you look at the experience of how we've dealt with renewables, and if you look at the data, just the sheer physics of what's possible with renewables, and if you're talking about just basic levels of energy that's available and the amount of energy that you get out of a barrel of oil that came out of Oklahoma in 1940 versus the amount of energy that you sink into and get out of a solar panel, if you take all those things into consideration, our camp feels that it's simply not possible to maintain industrial society as we know it with renewables, with things like unconventional natural gas. The physics just don't work.
Right.
But those are two very different conversations, and that's why this is so contentious and so important. If you believe the camp A, that technology will solve everything, markets will solve everything, you're going to pursue very different policies and make very different decisions at the household level, at the business level, at the community level, than you will if you agree with our camp.
Right, and people don't understand a lot of times. They just think about cars. Mm-hmm. They think about transportation, and that's kind of the end of the thinking about oil. And
exactly.
That's one thing. And the other thing is the extent to which we humans have trashed our our habitation.
Yeah.
Where we live is pretty terrible.
And that's another part that just never gets into the conversation, and it's what we try to. I think one of the biggest successes of this book, The Post-Carbon Reader, and by the way, folks, this is now available. It's on Amazon. It's on Powell's. It's at Powell's if you want to avoid the internet and go directly interact with some human beings. And we sold out our first printing, and our second printing left the warehouse literally 5 days ago. So if you tried to buy The Post-Carbon Reader recently and it wasn't available, even at our book reading last week, you were there. We had run out of books.
Yeah.
So the books are available now. Excuse me. I think one of our biggest successes with this is that we got these issues, everything from population to peak oil to health to education to biodiversity and many, many other things, all in the same book, all between these two covers. And I think that's really important because you're absolutely right. We can talk about oil and fossil fuels, and most people will think of it just in terms of their cars, maybe in terms of electricity consumption in their houses. Most people are not thinking about the ecological destruction happening up in Alberta, Canada.
Oh, it's horrible.
That's a result of us mining tar sands to produce more oil.
People getting desperate. The people, the companies.
Well, society getting desperate. I mean, this is the problem. We have not adequately prepared. So now we are willing to have disasters like the Athabasca tar sands, disasters like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill last year in the Gulf of Mexico, and people dying, and regimes in West Africa and elsewhere being completely corrupt. We are willing to put up with these things because we are desperate.
Yeah. And as is so often the case, I think most people don't know about a lot of these things because of the media, or they don't know the extent of it from what I'm hearing about the Gulf, for one thing, and the tar sands. I've been hearing, I actually did my first show about that matter, an interview with a Native American guy in Canada who was saying how this whole environment was just getting horribly trashed and the people were all sick and it was native land and native people. Mm-hmm. And so there's always so much more than most people, which often includes myself, begin to understand about the depths of and width of the effects of taking things out of the earth in the way that we treat the earther and not feeling
and of course
connected to it.
And there's nothing terribly new about that pattern. No. I mean, we've been doing that for many, many thousands of years at this point. I think this is where I get some ray of hope that thanks to the internet, largely, and thanks to this technology, this communications technology that I'm as guilty as anyone of railing against at times, it is now possible for most people to know what's going on. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, even back 15 years ago, the idea that you could go online and within literally 30 seconds find high-quality aerial photographs of destruction, say up in northern Alberta, of the land up there, or even the clear cuts in British Columbia and elsewhere, in such a short amount of time that anyone's able to do that, that's pretty amazing. That's very, very powerful, because that means that there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, hopefully millions of people who now know what is going on, and one would hope this can turn into political action. So I think there's a possibility here that really wasn't here 15 years ago, and a lot of these same things were happening anyway. Mm-hmm. The question now is, how do we convert that information into action? We feel that the transition movement, communicating about resilience, getting this information into the hands of policymakers, and not just the bad pictures and the data, but points of action, things that they can actually do, communicating those things, getting them into the right hands is an important first step. And that's really, you know, when Richard and I put together this book, The Post-Carbon Reader, Richard did the developmental editing, I did the direct editing with the authors. I think we both really saw it as, you know, this is obviously it's an education piece, but we also saw it as an activation product. And a couple times in the book, both at the beginning and at the end especially, we say very directly, you know, this is a book for people who want to get things right. This is a book that will tell you some of the first things you can do. Now that you've finished the book, get off your butt and go out and do something. And at the end of every chapter, we asked each author to list a few things that regular people can do quite easily. And in some cases, it's the usual, you know, call your representatives about this issue. And that's very important. We don't do that enough. I don't do that enough. In other cases, it's specific ideas. Like one of the last chapters by Chris Martinson, who many KBOO listeners would be familiar with, talking about personal preparation. You know, if we're talking about dealing with a future where we're going to be having higher and Good Lord, what's the word I'm looking for?
More
volatile.
Challenging.
I haven't talked about oil in about a year, so I lose the vocabulary. We're talking about volatile prices, and that affects prices for food and prices for other things. So we'll be dealing with localized crises. One of the first things that you need is to be prepared yourself so that you can help your community, so you can help other people. Things like talking to people in your school or in influencing policy, if you have children at your child's school. I mean, many easy little things that we can do.
Well, and it's going to affect, and already is starting to affect so many things, and people don't think about oil being in fertilizer for food. And then you put this together with climate change, and we really have a lot of challenges. Yeah. And people should have warm clothes available, and, you know, it might be, since it's not so cold today, but it was really cold the last couple days, and I thought, well, this is a little, my apartment was colder, and I thought, well, this, you know, put on the clothes, and this could get a whole lot worse. And it's really important to be prepared to the extent that one is able to do that, just with, like, warm clothes and some food, because, as I say, between the climate change and the oil, that it's really could dramatically change mm-hmm. how we live. But we can do it. People have been doing it. You know, it's the age of oil has been pretty short.
Yeah, and I know some people kind of scoff at that idea that, oh, we've got these huge problems and you're telling people to, you know, do canning and buy some extra rice next time they go to the grocery store or insulate their windows. What's that going to accomplish? I think that stuff is important. I mean, again, one, because it's important anyway. Again, Chris Martinson in his chapter, right at the beginning, he's talking about why this is important to do. And one of the points he says that because, you know, people used to do this all anyway without thinking 100 years ago. And if you didn't do it, your great-grandparents would yell at you.
Right.
So
right.
These are no-brainers we should be doing anyway. But I think even deeper than that, I think it helps ingrain this idea that we should not be assuming that everything is going to be taken care of for us. You know, again, 100 years ago, you couldn't make those assumptions. If you made those assumptions, you died, especially if you're out on the frontier, like here in Oregon or elsewhere. And because of fossil fuels, largely because of industrial society, we no longer have to think about where all these, not only where do the things that we need come from, but how these processes work. We assume that everything's going to be functioning just fine. So the more that we can change people's basic assumptions and get them to start thinking about, okay, I need to be thinking about how am I going to get what I need 5-10 years down the road? How are the people around me going to get what they need 5-10 years down the road? Let's not assume that everything's going to be okay. I mean, just in the paper this morning, EPA now saying that all cities should be texting for hexavalent chromium six. There was this issue where they found that this basically this cancer-causing chemical had cropped up in some cities around the country that they hadn't really been testing before. They tested for a little bit, but not in the right way. You know, we are so used to assuming that things are under control until things are not under control. So I think that's an important shift in mindset that if we can make that happen by getting people to think a bit more closely about where their water is coming from and how much food they have in the pantry, I think that does very tangibly translate into deeper shifts in the decisions that they make in government, in business, and elsewhere. And that's good for everyone. If everyone in this country was not assuming that oil was going to be available and affordable 5 years from now, we would be making very, very different decisions.
Right.
And that's important.
And there's a lot of things happening with water and with, you know, fights over water, and a lot of things are changing have already started changing very, very dramatically. But certainly you know this, Daniel Lurch, and I want to urge people to get this book, The Post-Carbon Reader, Managing the 21st Century Sustainability Crisis, because it's just really a good thing to be thinking about, and it's a... I've only had a chance to read about half of it. I really wanted to read the whole thing.
Only half of 544 pages.
I hardly ever read the whole book. But it's really interesting and engaging. So I urge people to to get that. And there's just so many issues happening at the same time. So the more informed we are, as usual, the better. We're going to be taking phone calls in a little while. So let's see, where's that phone number? Of course, now I don't see where the phone number is to the station. I just have a little piece of paper, but I'm not finding the little piece of paper. Okay. But I'm sure that Kurt can help us with that phone number.
Well, why are you doing that? Obviously?
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay. You want to see? Are you ready? Okay. 503-231-8187.
503-231-8187.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You ready? Ready for callers. Okay. Gordon, hi.
Hi, good morning. So, great. Great talk. So I guess, you know, I was listening a while back to a thing where we don't even know, we haven't even touched really the surface of the planet yet of what's down, what we're doing, where we're doing it. Because if you look at how much land is covered with ocean and what we haven't even seen, it's just amazing. And what's being affected by us that we've never even seen before, it's just really crazy on how our outreach from ourselves, what we affect in this planet. And since we're part of the planet, we affect the whole planet. I'm also finding as I get more mature that it isn't more an assumption. I think there's a clarity that happens when you grow and you're told or taught or programmed by individuals about what it is that we're doing and how energy, you know, I didn't even know until in my 20s where electricity came from energy. Really, I mean, really never paid attention as a child and as a teenager. That was the last thing on my mind. But as I become a parent and start seeing the real grip of capitalism, then I start really seeing that, and in that process, there's an assumption and then there's a realization. So there's this programming and being taught by people that don't know. Then there's this waking up and this assumption, and then there's this clarity of reality. And my reality now is that we need to rein in the corporations because they're the ones that are making us sick. It's not, forget about the climate change. It's the chemicals being spewed in our everyday life, like these EMFs and these carcinogens and Hanford's nuclear waste coming into our drinking water. So it's the corporations that I started thinking as I'm assuming that it's the corporations, but in reality, as I wake up, it's the shareholders that are ultimately responsible for everything that is going on in our lives today. And we, as people, are the shareholders because every time we purchase gas or food, we become ownership of that thing that happens. So so I find the assumption in the creation of reality. And so that's what I had to say about that.
Well, thank you very much for calling. And I want to remind people that you're listening to KABU 90.7 FM. And my name's Sue Supriano. And my guest is Daniel Lurch, who is a part of the Post Carbon Institute and is the author of The Post Carbon Reader, Managing the 21st Century Sustainability Crisis. And that's what we're talking about. And Kurt Lauer is the engineer. Thanks to Kurt for sure. We couldn't do it without him. And so yeah, go ahead, Daniel, respond to
that. Well, I just want to say something. Gordon, those are really interesting points that you made there. And I think what you're touching on is, again, some of the deeper issues of education and awareness of our responsibility. It's hard enough to wrap our heads around how all this stuff is working. This stuff, by this stuff, I'm meaning the way we think about it at Post Carbon is the E4 crises, four E's: energy, economy, environment, and equity. I recently completed a graduate degree in urban studies, focused on a lot of the stuff, and you know, just 2 years of intense study, I feel like I've just scratched the surface. So this is not easy stuff. And your point, your story that you didn't even realize where electricity came from until your 20s. You know, I was kind of in the same boat. I think we're all in the same boat. So you know, we're excuse me, we're putting people through the education system, and they get out and they become voters and they become decision makers in government, business, and their households, and they don't have, and this is changing, but for by and large, it's still the case. they don't really have a sense of how these systems that sustain us actually work. And not only do they not know how they work, they don't understand their culpability for the problems. So I really like your point that it's ultimately the corporations, and I think probably, you know, cable listeners are generally aligned with that concept. But, you know, the next step that, well, but who is responsible for the corporations? It's the shareholders and the voters who allowed corporations to have so much power. And yes, we protest against that, and yes, we struggle against that. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are each of us implicated in one way or another. And I know liberals, you know, we like to blame ourselves for pretty much everything because it's easy to do. So I don't want to go down that route too much. But I like that set of thoughts because it really shows me how that circle all comes around. Like, we don't know what we're doing. We don't realize that we're responsible for it. How then do we even begin to address it if we don't know those two basic things? How do we, you know, I remember there was that big political conversation right after 9/11 that people on the left were saying, well, we need to understand what happened and why these people did this so we can do something about it. And then a lot of people on the extreme right were saying, oh, well, you're coddling the enemy, all these pansy liberals wanting to just understand and hold hands. But, you know, we understand that we need to understand what's happening. And it kind of goes back to that old Pogo quote that a lot of baby boomers love. You know, we've met the enemy and he is us. We need to understand the enemy, which is us. And that's a big – it's not easy to do. Maybe we should have included a chapter on psychology in this book. I don't know.
Well, and of course, all these wars have to do with getting more oil as well. And so a lot of people are getting killed. And then who controls the oil? You know, it's so much of the same issues. I think we have more phone calls. Thomas is on the line. Hi, Thomas.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Wonderful topic, and very interesting to hear Mr. Lurch's comments and discussion. I guess I have a question and then a comment. My question has to do with the nature of the real problem that we're facing, particularly here in the United States. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, we all know very well, or at least most of us listen to progressive radio, of the deep-seated connections between, let's say, the Republican Party and the oil and gas industry in particular. But, you know, when we look at the deep connections of both parties, and, for example, with the Obama administration and the connection of several of the key cabinet people with Exelon Energy, which is the largest nuclear energy provider in the country. And as a showcase, we look at the voting record of the Blue Dog Democrats in coal states, which continually back the coal lobby and the mountaintop removal. And then we look to the rollout also of the Sarah Palin's energy offshore oil drilling program by the Obama administration. And the question is that realistically and soberly, can't we really say that in 2011, that in the United States in particular, that the real problem is a political problem with institutional and capture of the existing policymakers and politicians by mechanisms such, you know, legalized corruption mechanisms such as campaign financing? Isn't that the real problem? And my comment is, additional comment is, you know, I worry often that many extremely well-intentioned individuals and scholarly individuals and institutions right now, understandably, are talking about the very negative or frightening aspects that we could very potentially face, and indeed we will face, with peak oil and other crises of energy. I am very, very concerned that there's not enough of working with human psychology and focusing on the very real potentials. From my understanding, we know that there are recent studies on the amount of harvestable wind energy in the United States and the amount of harvestable sun energy, that if we could talk about the real potential for, you know, not just having to a future, grim future where we have a future of deprivation, but talking about the pluses, the absolute pluses that we could have if we went to a government-funded rollout of these existing technologies. And I think this would go a long way towards bringing people on board. Instead of talking about deprivation, talking about the possibilities of what we could look to have and to be proud of and to enjoy for ourselves and our children.
Oh, good idea. Thanks for calling.
Those are some great points. Well, I think to get to your second point first, that, you know, our shouldn't we be pushing the positives and not so much on the negatives? You know, I would argue that that's been tried and that's still being tried. I mean, read every second column of Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. I mean, he's constantly pushing this idea that we can achieve this green energy revolution now and have not only the success of our current economy, but it can go farther and farther. And there are other folks, former Vice President Al Gore is in that camp to a certain degree. And there's not a lot of folks saying that. I think by numbers, there are probably more folks on the doomer side. But those that Friedman's and other folks, they have a big microphone. And they get a lot of attention. Tom Friedman gets far more attention than Post Carbon Institute. And so I think even when Obama came into office, when the Democrats were really cleaning up in the 2008 election, there was a lot of that same rhetoric as well. And of course, you know, we can argue that, well, they didn't actually mean it because we know Obama's bought in with the nuclear industry and other things. But the rhetoric was there. I think if that was going to be done, it would have been done at this point. We certainly had probably our best chance we ever would have had in 2008 and 2009, and it didn't happen. And I think there's some reasons why it didn't happen, which I'm not an expert enough on that, and we don't have time enough to go into that. I think fundamentally it goes back to my earlier point that shifting to renewables, in particular, together with a connection on also pushing conservation, can only get us so far. We simply, from my understanding, is that it is physically impossible for us to be expending the amount of energy as we are currently with renewable energy and to maintain our industrial society. It's just simply not going to happen. You just don't have enough, you know, that people talk about that jackpot find of oil. You're talking about, you know, millions and millions of years of stored energy contained in this liquid form that we get, and we ship it around in barrels, and we're just not going to find something like that anymore in a form that takes so little energy for us to extract and then to use. So I think that's partly why that conversation of pushing the positive has not gone so far, because it's become the more we look into it, the more we see that it's just not going to be that easy. That said, I think you're right that, you know, and this is where I think the environmental movement historically has failed. This tendency to focus just on the negatives and not on the positives. I think there's some middle ground there. I think more importantly, there's some more creative ways of going about doing that. The caller's first point, though, can't we in 2011? Aren't we at the point now where we can just recognize that the problem is ultimately political? We need to take power back from the corporations and recognize that we have supposedly left of center politicians who get these issues but are still doing the same old stuff. I personally don't have a lot of hope on that. I think politics is its own separate beast. Politics works by a different set of rules that I think you don't really understand unless you're in the Beltway. And I'm not in the Beltway, so I don't fully understand it. That's why I don't get too involved in national politics. And we're more at Post Carbon. I think we have more hope for state and local politics because that's where the level of discourse is somewhat more sane. So I don't know. It absolutely is political, and we should be talking about the fact that it is political. But I personally don't think we have time or that we're going to achieve much by trying to get a national level political solution. I think just the cards are not in place for that to happen.
And that's why localization is so important, and to really organize and know our neighbors and support each other and do things at the local level as much as possible, because as somebody I know who's involved in this issue used to say, the world's going to get a lot larger, mm-hmm. not smaller, because the transportation, a lot of things, when you start thinking about how oil dependent we are, how much of our lives are dependent on oil, it's really pretty mind-boggling. So we have another call, and great, George. Hi, thanks for calling, and a talk on to Daniel Lurch and myself, Sue Supriano.
Well, I'm reminded that in the past years or so, we've had people come out to Oregon to lecture on the subject. Some of them are at the City Club, and some of them go on at Oregon State and the University of Oregon that actually gets on the TV if you get on the right station. And some of the people say, if you start to scare people about the energy crisis or any crisis, what happens is the people just shut down. They will not move forward. So it is a mistake to just emphasize the negative on this subject. Now, the other side of it is, I've heard, you know, from people even in the oil industry, we have no energy policy in the United States. There is no energy policy. I don't know how many times I've heard that one, and I think it's true. But an energy policy is a political policy. And if you want to have any resources developed or used, either you're going to let the corporations do it, or somehow you get some government organization to get it started. But there's nothing, no evidence that we have any, you know, we put on an energy policy and it's good for 1 year, and then they stop supporting wind farms, and the Vestas stop making turbines. So I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, in general, for the first time in the history of the world, most people are going to be living in urban environment, and that means you're not going to be doing stuff on your own. You're not going to be growing your own food. There has to be some new method of cooperation going on to live in an urban setting. Well, that's what I say.
Very good point. Thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. You're right. I really like how you described that there we have no energy policy in the United States. It's actually political policy, and you're absolutely right. I mean, we do – if we have the policy that we have, of course, is that we subsidize fossil fuels, and we consistently and generously, and we occasionally and very intermittently subsidize renewables almost as a token gesture. And we're still doing that. It really has not – it's changed, but it's not changed significantly enough to make a difference, and that has huge implications. And it actually kind of gets back to what the previous caller and I were saying about politics. If there's this ongoing inconsistency on the right things at the federal level, then just after a while, you have to focus at what's happening at the state and the local levels, because that's where things are going to happen. And that is in many ways what has been happening. Legislation on and action, even more importantly, on climate change in this country has largely been at the state and the regional levels. California's Assembly Bill 32 a couple years ago, the Global Warming Solutions Act, far more important than anything that's happened at the federal level so far. excuse me. More and more places, particularly in Canada, but increasingly in the states, are legislating allowing feed-in tariffs to encourage the investment in renewable energy. So these things are happening, but you're right. I think that the more that people can understand that it's not something that's going to happen at the federal level, that the federal level is all largely politics and not based on reality, the quicker we can go ahead. I think your first point that we can't overemphasize the negative, it turns people off. I think you're right there to a point, but I would argue that there is this constant stream of overly positive stuff that's coming over the airwaves. I mean, every day you can turn on cable news and you'll see someone reporting how wonderful these new recently discovered supplies of natural gas are, and we can power the country for centuries, and oh, we have more coal than we know what to do with, these sorts of things. There's this constant stream of happy talk that's going into the ears of voters and going into the ears of decision makers, and that needs to be counteracted in many ways. So that's what we're trying to do. But you're right. If it's all negative all the time, that's going to turn people off as well. I think that's where we failed in the 90s with too much negative talk about things like climate change and other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we didn't fail. I want to let people know that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and this show is called Political Perspectives. My name is Sue Supriano. My guest is Daniel Lurch, the co-editor with Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Reader, Managing the 21st Century Sustainability Crisis. And I have a reaction to this part about being positive all the time and not talking about negative things, because it's kind of hard for people to get it if you don't talk about the real facts, which are sometimes not so happy, especially considering what we're used to, and we can't really tackle the problem if we don't know what's there. So I'm often told that, and I just don't find another way to do it. And people just don't want to, or many people, not everybody by any means, it's general, huge generalization, but people don't want to get it and start doing something about it. People, meaning political groups, and that we see that the federal government is already changed and pulling back from being helpful in many ways and helpful in crisis situations. So the localization part is just so key. I totally agree about that, and we can't emphasize it enough. And that's, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I get to know each other.
Well, I think, and the positive negative thing, I think that that's also different in for different generations. I'm of the unnamed generation, between X and Y. I'm 36 years old now. So I grew up with this, I grew up during the Reagan years. And then I grew up, and then I spent my high school and college years right when all these concerns about ozone layer and global warming were coming to the fore. So I got this really steady dose of negative reinforcement the whole way through. And that's colored my career. That's colored the way that I think about things. Folks older than me, Gen X, and then the baby boomers, they would have had different experiences. I think baby boomers in particular, they got burned a few times. And I've seen this in my presentations. There's always some person that says, oh, we heard this back in the 70s. Then we heard it again in the 80s.
And now it's happening.
Yeah. But that's going to color their – it's that to counteract that idea or to work with those conceptions takes a different kind of – different information and a different kind of strategy. In post-carbon, we're increasingly interested in whatever you call them, the millennials, the kids in their 20s at this point. The kids are the baby boomers because they're the ones that are going to be really wrestling with us in the heights of their careers. And that's a generation that has gotten all the happy talk. They're the ones that grew up in the go-go years of the 90s and then the Bush years of this past decade. Those are the folks, makes me think of the first caller who mentioned, I don't know if he's a millennial or not, but, he said that, he didn't know where electricity came from until his 20s. I think that's a good example of the kind of mindset that these younger people have. And I'm not saying this to knock on younger people. I'm just, I'm sympathetic because, I lived during those decades, of course. I know I got very frustrated by a particular, I remember the late 90s. This is why I was not so much a fan of Mr. Gore back then, but more of a fan of Mr. Nader in the 2000 election, because I saw, oh, good Lord, it's going to be another 4 to 8 years of us continuing with the same corporate-driven economic growth, happy talk on sustainability issues. So we're dealing now, these younger people they grew up with that. They're only just starting to get that things are not quite what they had been told they were. So I think that they do need a certain dose of the negative talk. They do need kind of a slap upside the head, perhaps with my 544-page book here, to get them to realize that, no, life is not a Disney movie. And we know that you get that, but here are the details why. Here is exactly how you have been misled, and here are some steps that you can do to do something about it.
Exactly. I kind of think that, it's part of the plot to kill the messenger, and make it and be sure people are not informed. That's my own particular paranoia or whatever. But there's a lot of things it's important for people to know so they can deal with them. Mm-hmm. So the being positive all the time, no matter what, which is become in the – and I'm way older than you. I mean, like twice your age. And I just find this be positive and don't talk about anything negative is just really out of hand.
Yeah. Well, but I know, and I know a bit of your history. I mean, you've seen firsthand the other side of things. I know you spent some time in Central America and elsewhere,
all over the world.
And I think that's something that those of us who have had the opportunity to see other parts of the world, those of us who've been around long enough to see when things are not going very well, who know what it's like when unemployment gets above 10% and stays there for some time. I think it's incumbent upon us to tell those stories. And to essentially to represent to our communities, to our society, about just how bad things can get. I mean, I know we're starting to run out of time here, but I think this – I was thinking just this morning about, you know, the shooting in Arizona. And if there's any good that comes out of it, I hope that it will be a wake-up call that – you know, I don't want to overstate things. You know, there's plenty of people out there saying, oh, we're on the brink of violence and this sort of thing. And maybe we're, maybe we're not. But I think it is a good, very important and timely reminder that, you know, we put politics can be violent, just like business can be violent, just like just our inhabiting of this planet has been and can all and can again be and currently is violent. And If we're aware of that, if we know how bad things can be, if we hear those stories, we're more inclined to prevent them and to talk about them. And I would much rather, I feel terrible for the people who were killed in Arizona. I can only hope that that's a wake-up call to people to reform some of our political cultures, that we don't go down that route. But by the same token, I can only hope that the destruction that we see and the economic pain that we see right now perhaps encourages us to take some steps to solve, well, we can't solve. I don't think we can solve anything, but we can respond to do something about our energy and climate and equity issues before things do get bad. I mean, those of us that have been in less developed countries know that, you know, when things can get bad, it's really bad. It's right. Not fun.
Right. And there's a word collapse that I'm just realizing is a word that I like to use because it is collapse of a lot of systems that we're used to. And that doesn't mean it's the end of the world. It means, you know, we should get busy figuring out how we're going to do things another way, other ways.
Yeah. Things fall apart. So how do we keep right. them falling apart too much?
Right. Or make shifts that probably we should make for the good of ourselves, the planet, you know, the everything, because there's a lot of things that need to change for our own health and well-being and for that being true for a lot of species, living species. So do we have any more phone calls, Kurt? That's it? Okay, David, hi.
Hi, and actually I'm glad you said that last piece because there's a big difference between so-called positive news that's pretend positive news, like don't worry, it'll all be taken care of with natural gas, and actual constructive news about, well, here are the things that you can do individually and collectively. So I think that they're both for inspiration. For example, I read Yes magazine, and you see examples, including from the poorest places on Earth, where they are taking matters into their own hands on a local level, producing food, managing their water, working on collective management of their taxes and repairs of infrastructure and so forth. So those kind of stories or examples of real-world positive action are super important. And I think that was what I was going to say initially, that there's a great book, Amanda Ripley wrote a book, The Unthinkable, What Happens During Disasters and Who Survived Them. And it looks at the psychology of what happens when suddenly, you know, you're in the Twin Towers and they explode, and how people respond, or on the Titanic, a boat that is sinking, and how people can respond and who survives. And psychologically, you go through a process that I think we're going through collectively, where initially the shock puts us in a state of denial. Like, we don't want to deal with how bad it really is. So the first step is to realize just how bad it really is. You have to take an assessment or an analysis and come to terms with what's really happening. And I think
I'm going to interrupt you because we've got 1 minute left. So,
So in 1 minute, I'll say the following.
It would be nice to have Daniel have a chance to.
Let me just say one more thing, which is I heard a terrific lecture on KBOO by Kathy McMahon, who runs the site Peak Oil Blues. The full lecture is on EcoShock. And she talks about people's psychological, what they deal with, how their friends or relatives don't want to believe that it's difficult. And she talks about the stages you go through and not to get overwhelmed or depressed and to turn it into positive action and community.
That's great. Thank you for bringing that up, because that's really important. That's a great way to leave all this information. I got to say, that reminds me of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. But the book that you mentioned, The Unthinkable, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Speaking of books, so my book is The Post-Carbon Reader. You can get it at Powell's. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to our website, postcarbonreader.com. You might even find a discount there if you poke around a little bit enough. And I definitely encourage folks to read the book. We're in our second printing. We're trying to get it into universities across the country. It also makes for lovely fireside reading. It's not all academic treatises. There are some quite personal essays and very readable material on there. So The Post-Carbon Reader, edited by myself and the wonderful Richard Heinberg.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much, Daniel Lurch. And my name's Sue Supriano, and thanks to Kurt Lauer for being our engineer here on KBOO. And thank you to the listeners.